Hi everyone, and welcome back to Ezeoku Speaking Truths. This week, we continue our conversation on Renzo Martin's art film, White Cube, with guests Tessa Bahana, Mike Mavora, Ukona Mlandu, and Joaquin Gumi. We delve deeper into our conversation and touch on questions of agency, the politics of sustainability, hierarchies, power structures, and models that are community-driven.
So there was all this conversation about, you know, this is why we're doing art. Art is, you know, really about the imagination and about experimenting. And then, oh, we're going to use chocolate, but I'm not going to tell you about what's marketable behind this choice of material. I'm not going to tell you about who is curating this exhibition, where it's taking place, who has been invited. I'm going to present a big check to you for $2,000. That is probably a lot less than my one flight, my one return ticket to this place as one person, right? Like I was just thinking, you know, how many of these filmmakers, how many of these, you know, workshop facilitators have been brought in? I mean, if we're familiar with DRC, also the transport network to get to the places that they were, what were the expenses there? And what Renzo admitted that, you know, he was able to pursue his career and everything that he got. I mean, Mike touched on it, you know, with the Enjoy Poverty film. And so is White Cube yet another one of these kind of marketing elements for Renzo? And what does it mean that, I guess maybe just to repeat, I was just saying, you know, what does it mean for the White Cube also as a film, right? Like, I think so much of when we think about what art gets made and why, and how it fits into, you know, a lot of these questions we've been talking about with what it means to be a product and to be a brand, how does this also play into that with the film White Cube itself? And the power that we often go back and forth about, you know, art's responsibility for thinking about the economy and all of these things, and completely with Njoki and saying that, you know, why is it on art? And let's actually consider the mechanisms that relate to what art is getting made and who is getting to see it and who is talking about it. And I think that was something that White Cube is also implicated in as a film, as an art product. So that was something that I also just wanted to add to the previous conversation.
So the presentation of the film is almost like meant to invoke it as a kind of like an emancipatory practice, right? That breaks down, you know, hierarchies and kinds of like create a circle of, you know, community and cooperation between Renzo Martin and this collective in the DRC. But he has got the choice and the freedom to leave when shit hits the fan, right? Is what happens with the first plantation. So when they are confronted and the email comes from London and they're told to stop, he's actually on his way out and he's telling the team, we can leave, you know. But the people who actually live there, you've got no choice. This is the only space and this is the only place that they have, right? So that's also, I think, a problem around, you know, the choice that he actually has as a white man, because I think they actually speak to him as the embodiment of William Lever, you know, within that space. So questions of, you know, like agency and questions of like who actually decides on what the community actually needs. You know, I think we spoke about chocolate as a material. Is this what the community actually, you know, decides on that they want to use chocolate as a material? There's also kind of like those things like, oh, you're invited to a conference. Does the community want a conference, you know? So there's almost like this kind of like top-down, you know, kind of like narrative of what actually gets done. But the film itself is actually presented as if it's like, you know, very participatory and very consultative. Yet, you know, we see all these glimpses over and over again in the film of actually like, this is how it's going to happen. So the hierarchy is still there, but the film itself is actually presented almost as if it's like, you know, emancipatory and kind of like circle making and trying to break kind of like hierarchies.
Does that art piece that the nameless man, note all of them are nameless, we never get their full names, so we can't even look them up now to see where they are, but we know Renzo Martins. But there's the one of the men there says he's made an art piece, he calls it the Fanda, and he says the Fanda controls the solutions, whether good or bad. And again, it speaks to this, I'm not gonna assume that this guy didn't know that this power dynamic, but the fact that through this process, he's doing an iteration of a power dynamic that he's observed, whether before with Eliva and whether with Renzo Martins in this current moment, where it's clear that the dynamic that Mike is speaking about is very much there, and the fact that they're nameless and faceless.
Mm. I completely agree with you, Connor. I feel like I had wanted to agree with Mike specifically with regard to the film, like almost in spite of itself, in spite of its own best intentions, finds its way back to centering white progressiveness at having the audacity to make a film that perhaps might make itself look bad. But then with regard to the, and I remember thinking that about the conference, you know, where people are Skyping in, you know, just, it's just like wild. Like I was thinking, you can't even script a thing like this if you are a filmmaker. You can't, like, nothing in you can do it. And then, you know, reality just goes and boils everything over. And I remember wondering, this thing is happening also in the evening when these people have come from a long day of, you know, harvesting. So even like the kind of leisure time that they have, they're supposed to kind of give it to this man to share his ideas that are coming from his own thinking and people from a school of thought that he shares, without asking the people anything directly about themselves and where they're coming from. So I remember wondering about that. I also one of the most kind of NGO type questions that gets asked in Kenya is, and I think this might be similar with a bunch of places where we come from, is you know, quote unquote, what about the people on the ground? You know, it's a question that imagines that urban people with, you know, formal education know a lot more about X and Y and Z than others. But this man who has likely never been abroad, you know, the minute he enters the museum, he's asking all the right questions. He's like, hi, how did these things arrive here? And then he listens very carefully to the answer, and he knows this woman is being shrewd when she's kind of talking about, like, maybe about a step back, we know, but it becomes a bit fuzzy about how it leaves Africa. And he's like, okay, I see you. Then now, immediately when he enters the room of storage, his conversation is with the object. It's not with these people. And like, he does these things instinctively, you know? So there's a lot of conversations around, oh, you know, rural people don't really care about conversations with regard to object return or conversations about, you know, decolonial work because, you know, them, they're just looking for their food. And I'm like, people don't understand, you know, the things that Africans are carrying that we have embodied, you know, the things that have come through, and the conversations that we can have when they're not necessarily being guided by anybody else, just because of like a couple of questions, you know, which for me was a really beautiful thing. I do want to say one thing about the arts, that, you know, like we're always kind of caught in this polarity of the arts, you know, being having a responsibility towards humanity, towards communities of human beings, towards asking and answering large questions that it's very difficult for other spaces to ask and answer. I do not feel, however, that community building and making is the sole proviso of the arts. I don't think that making people well, wellness, health is the sole proviso of the arts. I don't think it should be the arts' work to resuscitate a dying capitalism, because that's what we are facing now, that capitalism is dying. And so to ask the arts to come and revive it is to ask the arts to participate in one of the most wholesale betrayals of care and of humanizing that there has been in a long time. I think the arts can participate. I think the arts can lead. I do not think that the arts should be left solely responsible, because the minute that they are, everybody else will just know to A, work against it, and that B, the arts are consistently, especially in our part of the world and in the global south, they're consistently and purposely underfunded because of their political power, and that they're consistently kind of pushed to the side with regard to people having bigger needs than what the arts can give. So there's a lot of stuff that we have to work through with regard to attitudes towards the arts and conversations that are hosted by artists and among the arts. But yeah.
I'm just gonna quickly throw something out there, because a lot is happening and I'm here for it and I'm living for it. And I don't want to lose, these are kind of like, maybe they're questions or a sort of thing to think through and we can jump in and figure this out. So we've talked about, I love that, I think it was Ukona who brought up the funder, that specific piece, right? And I wanted to ask about or think through art and how it relates to capital. I think it's been touched on that art cannot save in the way that other sectors need to step up and do that work. In the documentary, Matthew Kasiyama makes a statement. He says, earth or art? If I had to choose, I would choose both. But if I had to choose only one, if I had to choose between art and earth, I would choose earth. So he's touching on the idea of art as a means to an end, right? Another thing that's touched upon is the idea of sustainability. That also comes to mind. Renzo's first attempt at working with the community didn't pan out. And in his second attempt, working with the community in Lusanga, he builds a white cube space. Now, do you think this is a sustainable space?
Yeah, I mean, I think, first of all, like, why are these things in, why is there a dichotomy between most of them, right? Like, this question of art versus the land, in a lot of our cultures, there wasn't this separation between what is art and what is the land. And land is, there's so many rituals and particular things that happen, you know, dances with the harvest or patterns that are, have, you know, aesthetic values that are used on how people construct their homes, you know, rites of passage that come with, you know, certain adornments. Art was part of us. Like, it wasn't ever this removed thing that is about specific objects having certain value and being marketed in a certain way. And so, you know, while I think there was something quite poignant about the way Matthew, you know, we had that quote to end the film. And in fact, you know, to me, Matthew was like really the saving grace of like making it through so much of the trauma of the film. But I think that is a false dichotomy and something that really is something that so many of us are grappling with if we are interested in being a part of what is termed as art in these times. Then also this question of sustainability. First of all, why is it a white cube? Who, just like, what was the kind of designing and thinking behind these processes? I mean, they did make it seem as though there was community involvement in conceptualizing the space, but how is it white on an area of geography that is surrounded by earth and lushness and green? How do we bring a literal white cube to that space? I think that is that just encapsulates so much of the problematics that are explored in this film in a physical space to me. And then this question of sustainability, like, sustainable to what sense? Like, in what sense? When we think about something surviving economically, often you are forced to survive economically by growing to no end. We, again, in these communities have had histories and legacies and knowledge of how to work within the environment, how to live, how to have leisure time, how to actually dream, all of these things. And so these notions of sustainability and of development are again divorcing us from what used to be. And so to end the film in this way with this physical space that is an importing, it's physical importing of a very harmful, I mean, that's not even a fair enough word to encapsulate, I think, what that structure is and what it represents. So those are my thoughts. I'll hand over to you, Mike.
Thanks for your thoughts. And just to complement what you were saying, I think the power relations embedded in this project, you know, it's dependent on Renzo Martins. You know, the sale of the sculptures is dependent on Renzo Martins in either Amsterdam or in New York. So should something happen to him, what then happens? I think the embedded power structures and the hierarchies created by, you know, geography, the Congo, and then globalization, and then, you know, art spaces in New York and Amsterdam, I think it's not sustainable in that way, because it's actually dependent on the presence of, you know, this white man, Renzo Martins. So I think that that then becomes problematic. And I'm also very wary of the pressure that's put on the arts for, you know, kind of like economic sustainability of, you know, post-plantation. Here you've got a global corporate, Unilever, which has got 400 products, which has been exploiting this land for over 100 years. And then, you know, it actually discards this space, like it's no longer useful for anything. And then we expect the arts to resuscitate an economy where, you know, within a space where global capitalism has actually exploited milked every ounce of this land and productivity of this land. And then afterwards, they really don't no longer have got any use for it. And then the expectation that it's the arts out of every other sector that has got the responsibility to resuscitate an economy, I think that's too much pressure. And I don't think that's quite realistic in terms of what we understand by sustainability. And I think we need to expand and unpack our understanding of sustainability. You know, we're talking about a community and the people who have been exploited for over 100 years, you know. So there are things that need to be, you know, kind of like repaired, things like trust, you know, relations, and all these other kinds of things. These pressures are not put on, you know, sectors like religion. They're not put on the scientific sector. They're not even put on the government. They're not even put on the Ministry of Arts and Culture in the Congo. But we expect the arts, you know, and artistic practices to do all that work after capitalism has exploited people, resources, the environment, everything that can be exploited. And then the pressure now, the penny now drops on the arts to become this kind of like all-solving sector for all these problems. I think it's an unrealistic expectation to some extent.
So the way that I experienced that white cube in the middle of a village was that it was phallic. It imposed itself, and it Renzo Martins, despite himself, could not divorce himself from his own conceptions of the politics of value creation, that when he was wanting to derive value from whatever it is that he was doing, that he still fell back and leaned on this thing for what it means to him as a physical structure and what it did to validate what he was doing. And also his ideas of what sustainability means for him, you see them play out, and they still very much have a colonial lens. And so it got me thinking about, when we talk about, I mean, I run an organization that has been around for 30 odd years, and I often grapple and think through and chuckle at what has become known as an understanding of what sustainability means. And it often also includes the forever giving prominence and voice to either the funder or the white founder. So the person who has the money, or the person who consider themselves to be the founder of the thing, right? And so what and without constantly playing those politics and maneuvering that thread, your sustainability is considered to be under threat, And therefore, what space do you give yourself in this attempt to decolonize what sustainability means? To go, sometimes a dynamic has to die in order for a new dynamic to emerge. I mean, I'm saying a lot of things because my head is all over the place around this, but these are some of the things that came to my mind as I was thinking about this phallic concept of how this guy understands this value that he's coming to create and impart on this community.
I really love what everybody has said. I think another way of trying to understand, you know, this kind of golden ticket to sustainability, there are a lot of, if you were to draw a Venn diagram, there's a lot of words that usually appear alongside anywhere where people are trying to make Africans talk about sustainability. One of them is innovation, which then means that, like, you have to look at everything really with a lot of suspicion. Especially because a lot of the entities that ask of other entities to be sustainable have already figured out their plan, and chances are their plan was not kind of market access and getting people to pay for your services, which is what essentially everybody else is trying to ask you to do. Can you get people to pay for your work? What you are receiving funding to do now. I think it's weird for governments to ask people to be sustainable when governments only run on people and taxes and massive loans that the people who take don't have to pay back. I think sustainability can be better understood by seeing who is never asked to be sustainable. And it's very possible to kind of look and see, oh, okay, who doesn't have to be asked about sustainability because there's already a plan. If we look even at Unilever and that little film at the beginning where we were informed that, a lot of government work went into it being founded. Unilever, like, it's not some bootstrapping story. It's the story of colonialism and etc., which is the only reason that it can go to a massive modern museum and claim to be a patron of the arts, you know. So when now these same kind of business frameworks are being used to demand of Africans who are doing the patchwork of trying to hold systems, sectors, communities together in all these different small ways. I think it's definitely an issue. So I feel like it's one of those words that needs to be thrown back at the people who ask it.
Can I just quickly say something? Njoki, I love what you said about who is never asked to be sustainable, and I'm going to be using that with your permission. But I think, you know, we were talking a lot about what is expected of art and like the responsibility art is given. And to be honest, art is nothing much is expected of art here in Uganda, like from government. No one's asking us anything. And I think that's part of what, to me, art's power has, that also really relates to so much of what we're saying, is that it really is about thinking about value, right? Like, what does it mean to create something that maybe does not have a monetary value? Obviously, there is this complete, within the arts world, art sphere, we have this combination of both, right? Where people can create things that you cannot sell whatsoever. And then people create things that all of a sudden, because of, you know, the economics of art, and, well, not even the economics of art, the economics of our current capitalist system that has decided that this is a very good way to park money, to inflate prices of things, you can have things selling at astronomical prices. But with both of them, you are able to think about value in very particular ways that often the rest of the world kind of just marches on without really stopping to critique or like to see, you know, what is sort of invisible? What are these layers behind, you know, even the way the White Cube is presented as a film? What are they not telling us? What is not being said? And I think that those are really powerful things that art is able to bring to conversations, to systems, two societies, obviously cannot do everything, but that is, to me, like really transformative. There's a lot of transformative potential in that.
The conversation there, I think, is less about the direct flow of resources, because if you have five people who, you know, are giving to everything that they can, are mentoring as much as they can with their own time, you are limited by the bounds of the individual at any given point in time, unless maybe you are Bill Gates, and that is a conversation for another day, because you know the existence of Bill Gates is why we have this dying, you know, capitalistic frame. But the question is, you know, first of all, we have to process like government betrayal, because the promise of government, while kind of living within the bounds of these things that we call countries and nation states, is that, you know, that the government was supposed to put together all these resources and then use them to take care of individuals equally. That didn't happen. And we've been processing that from a political space, but maybe processing it from the space of, you know, communities might be an interesting way to think it through. And there's also the fact that capitalism has made us view family and community in very different ways, that capitalism and its labor has been gendered, because, you know, we are capitalists in a patriarchal dispensation. And so some people have gained more than others from these spaces. So there's that as well. And so even the fact that we have to talk about this as a community, we are entering it from different levels and with different points of grievance and different levels of grievance. And the fact that like the violence of this capitalism has been worse on some people than others, because some people were given the combinations of different tickets to be able to leave the kind of nonsense that everybody else is having to deal with. And we cannot solve for all of that, you know, by paying penance or amends as individuals, because it is not an individual problem to solve. So I think that beyond, you know, like as an artist, how can I give back the most, what? I think even the question of giving back should stop being an individual question and become a much larger question. I think we should challenge the things that we have trusted to give back that haven't, because they're the ones that have made massive failures. We should challenge even this idea that, for instance, a corporate is the best person to decide what its CSR and corporate social responsibility is going to be. I think that's a problem, and that other people need to be able to have input into that. And so I think what we are facing is less, you know, a crisis of resource, but a crisis of responsibility. And I don't think, again, and I keep going back to this thing, and I'm sorry, but I like that artists can set examples, and I like that artists can be able to depict these things, imagine new ways of responsibilities and accountabilities and demanding these things, and make those ways interesting and possible for publics. But I also don't think that it's their sole responsibility, and that it shouldn't be artists who then have to kind of like, you know, sacrifice on behalf of everybody else. That one I completely refuse. I feel like the altar is for us all. If anybody's going to sacrifice on it, I resent this idea that it should be artists first, because it says many things about who should be first, where and why, and who wasn't first, where and why.
Thanks, Joki, for your contribution. I really like your term of the crisis, or a crisis of responsibility. And it's quite interesting, Precious, that there's this kind of like pairing between Ibrahim Mahama and Renzo Martins in different spaces, right? You see them in Berlin, I think you see them in Lagos as well. And I suppose that even that presentation kind of like speaks to this crisis of responsibility. So there are three things here around, I suppose, art practices or art spaces on the African continent, where you know, one can question the responsibility of the government, and then, you know, around most of our countries have got this kind of like strange creature called the Ministry of Arts, Culture and Sport. And it's meant to kind of like fund everything from art practices to volleyball and cricket, you know, and these things don't quite sit together. And I think maybe Ukona, you can jump in after around, you know, the space that you run, and, you know, do you receive government funding from, you know, the Ministry of Arts, Culture and Sports and all those kinds of things. So I think that crisis of responsibility then leaves gaps and cracks for sometimes Western philanthropy to come in the same way that within the development sector, you see these things called non-governmental organizations that populate every other African countries that come in to fill in that void. But what's been interesting is that they are now kind of like local initiatives of artists who are, you know, getting revenue from their artistic practices and realizing that, you know what, we can't depend on the government, we can't depend on the Western kind of like philanthropy. So none but ourselves, we have to do this work by ourselves and reinvest in building the kind of like institutions that speak to us, for us, and by us. So you see the work of Ibrahim, for example, you see the work of AAF itself, you know, Village UNU in Zimbabwe, Nafasi Art Space in, you know, Tanzania, and so on and so forth, you know, Picha in the Democratic Republic of the Congo, and so on and so forth. What's interesting is also that we are actually having this whole discussion around Renzo Martin's, you know, film and practice rather than all these other practices that have emerged on the continent. So I think this narrative of the crisis of responsibility really puts, you know, these ministries that are responsible for, you know, arts, culture and sports in a spotlight, and then kind of like Western philanthropy initiatives, Renzo Martins, by extension in the development sector, the NGO sector, which he really probably kind of like projects himself as for the art sector, and other funders, you know, for our artistic projects, you know, be it the Goethe Institute, you know, Pro Helvetia and all these other ones. And the kind of like really initiatives that are mushrooming across the continent, from artistic initiatives, project spaces, gallery spaces, that's really mushrooming across the continent. I think on that spectrum, we can have interesting conversations around who is doing what, where, and how. Yeah, I'll leave it there.
Yeah, maybe just to jump in on that. I mean, in Uganda, art is under the Ministry of Gender, Labor and Social Development. So we don't even make it into the title of the ministry. You can imagine where we even fall under, which in some ways, really. which, you know, in some ways, I think allows us a bit more flexibility and room to be a bit more subversive and critique and things like that. But, you know, as much as we want to also do things for us, by us, et cetera, the capital, the resources, the funding, it is not here, it is not. And there are reasons for that, you know, because of extraction and exploitation. And so as much as possible, if we are able, when we are in rooms with the funders, to speak to that, I think that, you know, becomes some of the work that we have to do, that we are forced. The thing is as well, this question of community, right? Because it is often with this work, and going back to the film of White Cube, like who is Renzo's community, for example, versus who is Ibrahim's community? And often, you know, when we're doing this work, sometimes we're in a position where, like, oh, there's some kind of elevation because, you know, we're on the front lines and looking for funding and running these programs. But I mean, I do this job also because I really love it. I'm doing it for me too. Like, this is part of my community. I want to see this in the world. I am friends and family with so many other people that I get to also work with. And so I think, you know, that is something that we also can't separate from what we're doing and why it has
an impact, it also means that we are able to be more responsible and accountable to each other. It's easier to then call someone out for what they've done when you've built a relationship and have, you know, the kind of dynamic where you can understand where someone's coming from, understand their intentions, and be able to work with them and grow together, as opposed to it being something completely separate to that. And so I think when it comes to long-term existence, I don't know about, you know, sustainability, thriving or whatever, it has to come with community and relationships and connection. The structure that that all takes place in, who's to say? Because often, you know, these things are really difficult to fund and to physically sustain. But at the base of it, at the heart of it, I think is our community, right? Yeah.
Gosh, there's so much going through my mind by way of trying to answer this. But I can just share that, like, the particular organization that I'm running, it starts off as an artist-led community of practice in the 80s. And it's kind of quite revolutionary in the way that it's mixing people from different racial backgrounds and they get into it and they're making art. But it would be silly of us to not consider and keep in mind that, you know, some of the major contributions that happened in that time, whether in the form of the building that we're in, or just the voices that have a lot more, a lot more bandwidth, they will be white people in the 80s, right? It will be the white person who can donate the house. It will be the white person who can write themselves into history as the founder of the thing. But at the same time, I always go back to the idea, what was that artist-led community of practice? What can we learn from that moment? But as you watch the trajectory of the organization, you begin to see it now formalizing and then going into this idea of like registration and formalizing. But then also, while there are certain resources and respectability that comes with that, there are other things that get that kind of fall by the wayside. So you begin to see less and less of the artist having a voice and them being treated as a kind of like a means to an end to sustain the administrative beast, which is strange, right? Because the core mission is the art. And so I share these two examples to say, at different stages, the organization has been different things, depending on who was at the helm and what they prioritize, and probably because of the needs of the moment and what they necessitated. Now, fast forward to post-pandemic world, where all of the our own ministry, like, they don't care. But then also there's this idea of that everybody has spoken about this, the international cultural agencies, which are mostly Europeans, who fill in the gaps that our governments can't fill. And I sit in some platforms where I sit with other colleagues from across the world, where we're trying to feed back to these organizations about how it is that they can still support us, but still understand that they still come from a problematic perspective, in that they are countries that colonized these African states at some point, but now they're coming in and being the enabler and the voice giver of the most controversial artists. So what does that, how do we, what is that dynamic, and what does it mean for them to be funding these institutions when they're always insisting on participation by the artists? What are some of the ways that they can show us solidarity, reparations, and some kind of justice by giving us the money without waving their flags while they're doing this? So this is also part of the conversation of the now. But also there's another conversation that is emerging for me in particular at Great Moore that says, what does a artist-led community of practice look like now? How do you, as artists who are here now, determine what the agenda, the tone, the priorities, and the ethics of our collective care? How do you begin to to take ownership of this thing and make it have the texture that you need it to have, as opposed to having the funder that controls the solutions, whether good or bad, that is referred to in this documentary. So I think I share all of that just to say that it's an ever-shifting thing. I know that with me right now, while I'm at Greenmore, what I'm prioritizing is an artist-led community of practice, which centers around ethics of collective care. And absolutely, I'll take money from any source, but I must not feel like it. At the end of it, the main objective, which is the artist, is compromised in any way. So
I do want to just kind of reiterate what I had said before, that there's a way sometimes when we frame these conversations that the artist is seen as an outside actor. They're acting outside of the community when they are indeed human beings who are part of the community themselves. There are ways in which definitely we will feel and process the grief and have language for it that are not the same language that'll be heard by people who are doing different things, who have different skill sets, who understand things differently. And I think that is a good thing, because also we can learn so much from the ways that everybody else is thinking and feeling. For us, at least with the work that I've done with The Nest, one of the things that we always say is that our work is not complete until the people have met it and come back with comments. So we can have made this thing that we think is stunning, we imagine it's going to say these things, and then it meets the people and the people are like, wait, that scene is dark, we don't like that character, we don't appreciate you exploring this theme in this way, and like all of that stuff is really useful, because it also lets you know how much your alignment with your communities are manifesting. Whether you feel like you need to be in alignment with the community to have a certain conversation, whether you need to be out of sync to either hang back a little bit or move forward. And then of course the conversation we had about making a hard thing bearable, making a tough thing look like it's a thing that we should want. I think that's definitely not a skill we should take for granted. So I guess maybe I can finish on those, I hope, hopeful words.
Okay. So okay, maybe my most prominent thought right now, and it's a learning from this time, is that even in community, the community is a reminder. This is just a reminder that even communities are not homogenous, and that in building community, one needs to be aware of that people come into this community from different entry points. And that at the moment for me, what is also very important is that when trying to build something, to understand that it does mean that you must get your hands dirty, and different people within the community, that means different things to different people. And that even in the times when there is discord, I at the moment, because the world is increasingly becoming cancel culture, I want to lean in towards repair. And so in whatever I am, this community of practice that I keep on harping on about, I also am quite keen to like to connect with people who understand that things aren't always going to be perfect, because you've just said you are in a community. You need to be able to invest in the community that you claim to want to be part of. I think that's it.
Thanks, Ukona. Just grateful for this opportunity and for sharing thoughts and absorbing ideas from such intelligent people and creatives. I'm very grateful for that. But just to mention that, you know, even this conversation, even Renzo Martin's practice, Ibrahim Ahmad's practice, the ideas that have been shared here are super helpful for me. I'm trying to, in my own work, trying to engage with the rural community of Murewa in Zimbabwe on a piece of land that used to belong to my grandparents who have since passed on. And I'm also grappling with questions of, you know, power, of, you know, trying to kind of like know, understand what the community needs. So what we have done is we have just appropriated one wall of a house and made it into kind of like a blackboard. And what we do is we just buy chalk and we allow the community to express themselves on this blackboard. This has been going on for 6 months. So I'm going to allow this process to be very slow and organic so that we kind of like, you know, get what the community needs from, you know, what they express on this blackboard, but also even ideas of play. So we are working a lot with the youth. I'm not there. I haven't said anything. All I do is they tell me that chalk is finished and I buy chalk. So they've got the power to express themselves, also giving agency to them to really express themselves and to do the things that they need to do. And maybe after a year or so, that's when we'll think of the next step. So I think these are long processes. I really like Ukona's idea of repair. And I think when building community, so these things take time, but I'm super grateful for this conversation. And my notebook is full of notes that I've been taking from what the others have shared. So super grateful.
These conversations give me energy. They remind me to keep going, that what we do matters, has value beyond what we could even conceive of. So just wanted to share that. And thank you to Precious and AAF for bringing us together as well.
Thank you to my guests, Tessa Bahana, Mike Mavura, Ukona Mlandu, and Joaquin Gumi for their thoughts and insights on White Cube by Renzo Martins. I hope you enjoyed the conversation and look forward to seeing you again in the next podcast episode.